This is Stories from the Space Between, the podcast from the Space Between Society. Today, we're talking about modernism and technology. I'm Michael McCluskey, and I'm with Alex Goody and Ian Whittington, editors of the new Edinburgh Companion to Modernism and Technology, just published in September 2022. Professor Alex Goody is professor of 20th century literature and culture at Oxford Brookes University, and among other publications, she's the author of Modernist Poetry, Gender and Leisure Technologies, Machine Amusements from Palgrave Macmillan, 2019. And Dr. Ian Whittington is associate professor of English at the University of Mississippi, and among his other publications, he's the author of Writing the Radio War, Literature, Politics, and the BBC, 1939 to 1945, and that's from Edinburgh, 2018. Our focus today is the Edinburgh Companion to Modernism and Technology that Alex and Ian co-edited with, what, about 28 contributors, 28 chapters, four sections, machines, media, bodies, systems. It has it all. But to start off, could you just tell us the story behind the volume? What was the impetus? What's the intervention you're trying to make? What does the book tell us about modernism and about modernist studies and about technology?
Are we okay to use the M word in this, seeing as we're the space between? Am I right to talk about modernism
Of course. And this will stay in the episode.
I think modernist technology studies is, you know, maybe two decades old now. So it came a little bit after the invention of the new modernist studies. So it arrived at the party a little bit after the new modernist studies. And, you know, there's been some really significant volumes that kind of, define the field. And I'm thinking particularly about Tim Armstrong's, you know, Modernism, Technology and the Body, and Sarah Dennis's Centres of Modernism. And I think, you know, by the time we got to this volume, and it's in the Edinburgh Companion series. So, you know, there's, and can I just shout out now to Edinburgh as one of the best presses, actually the best press I've ever worked with. So, you know, all kudos to them on this. I mean, I think what we wanted the volume to do was to kind of bear witness to the richness and the diversity of modernist technologies, that it's to how far it's come in the last two decades. And I think, you know, we wanted to really showcase new work in the field. So there would have been approach to a volume like this where you just go, okay, who are the key canonical critics, academics writing in this? Let's just email them all and put them all in a volume. Actually, we wanted newer voices. We wanted to kind of be thinking at the edges of that field rather than consolidating the center of it. And there is quite an expansive view of technology in it. You listed the sections. And I think, you know, I was approached by Edinburgh to kind of do something like this. And I started on my own. And I think I had a narrower idea of what was going to be in it until I started speaking to Ian about it. And Ian really brought that thinking about, you know, about systems and so on. I was hung up, I think, on machines. And I think we ended up with a volume that is not just about machines and not just about media, but is about other ways of thinking about technology and other ways of technological thinking. So yeah, that's my thoughts on it as well. So it's not, you know, it's not a, I don't know, it's not canonical. It's a, like you say, it's a kind of intervention. It's not exhaustive. And I did want to point out that 16 of our contributors are women, and that was really important to us as well. We didn't want this to be reproducing a certain idea of what modernist technology studies is, who does modernism and technology. We really wanted to kind of showcase the diversity of voices and make sure there are lots of women in there.
Yeah, and I would just add, I think Alex already alluded to this, but people at every stage of their career, and, you know, from some folks in more contingent positions as well. So that was, that was absolutely important to us. The systems sort of approach, I think it came to my mind because it seemed like the one thing that had started to gain steam in modernist technology studies just in the last sort of 5 or 10 years, people talking more about infrastructures and institutions. And that seemed like an important thing to include to bring the volume right up to the present as far as modernist technology studies go. I was just thrilled to be asked to collaborate on this by Alex. So thank you for that opportunity. It's been a real pleasure.
He was, honestly, this is a love fest. He was the best co-editor. He was just marvelous. He was wonderful.
Go on.
What, just to pick up on that, one of the stories your introduction, Modernist Technology Studies, tells, and I'm speaking quite broadly here, is it seems to tell the history of, or a history of, modernist studies' interest in technologies, if that's correct. And it seems like modernist studies was first interested in cinema, and then it was radio, and then it was maybe sort of domestic or domestic machines or transportation, and now we get this rich work on information studies and institutions. If you could just speak back to me, is that about right? Do I have that history about right? Is that one of the stories you wanted to tell, was the history of modernist studies engagement with different technologies?
I'd say that is one of the stories we wanted to tell, that sort of shifting of focus from an emphasis on either individual authors and their relationship to technologies or individual technologies themselves. I think there's a kind of relationship between the rise of post-humanism and an understanding of technologies, not as just these tools we use, there's a kind of diffusion of agency, both in the forms of posthumanism that are thinking about animals and other forms of the non-human. We have a chapter on germs, for example, in this book, and the sort of interface between a sort of medical technology understanding of germs and the human body. So there's a connection between that kind of posthumanist thinking about how agency is distributed beyond the human, and seeing technologies as part of these sort of systems and the ways that technologies can kind of have a bit of agency. They're not just a tool at our disposal. So I think that that's coming to that understanding as part of the trajectory we're tracing. Not that everybody shares that view, of course. There's every different perspective on modernism and technology represented here, I think, or a great many. But Alex, would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I think it's a story. It's not a teleology. It's not like we started off just thinking about photography and cinema, and now we need to think about this. I think you're right, Mike, that if you look back over the last 20, 30, 40 years, there is, it does start off with an interest in cinema. It does, because there just seems to be that convergence between, particularly canonical writers, in the way that modernist studies tends to start with the canon and then move outward. So you have Joyce and you have Wolfe, and you can tie them into the cinema in all sorts of ways. So it just, those were the kinds of stories that were being told. And I think, both myself and Ian are interested in radio, and that seemed to be quite a significant movement and development in modernist technology studies, shifting to think about the significance of radio. And even that area of study has expanded. So it's not just about radio, it's about sound in a much, much more expansive and interesting way. So, kind of modernist sound studies in a way has its origins in the kind of interest in radio and so on. So I think you're right to say there is that kind of story, but you can stop anywhere you like in that story and then just dig in and find something of interest, in kind of the way that different modernist writers and artists just engage with, rethink, resist, or do something interesting with technology and technological system.
And if we could dig into your personal stories, just mentioning the radio studies, Ian, I'm pretty sure you came into technology, modernist technology studies, through the radio. If each of you could just mention what interested you in, did you start off thinking about, I want to look into this particular technology? Did you start off thinking about a particular writer who was interested in technologies? I'm just curious, what was your pathway into modernist technology studies before this wonderful collection, companion?
I absolutely am a radio first technology guy, but I came into radio studies through my interest in the Second World War. So I did a master's on novels about the Blitz, and in reading about the experience of bombardment in Britain, I was spending a lot of time thinking about the soundscape, the larger sensory environment. And so when it came time to think about what I might be interested in for doctoral research, I realized that, there was this vast untapped archive of radio related material. And I think I probably started by being interested in what it would have felt like to be in that sonic environment. And then my interest sort of shifted to what how writers were contributing to that sonic environment at the BBC in particular. So it was kind of it grew out of a greater interest in the cultural history of the Second World War, and the sort of political function of literature. And then that led me towards the BBC. And I mean, goodness, I don't know if I will do, you know, radically different stuff in the future, but I know that there's so much still to discover there, and so many people doing interesting work with respect to radio and modernism that you know, there's a lot of great work still to be done. So Alex, I don't know how you would describe your entree into this.
You know, there's a very, very long version of this, so I'm going to give you a very abbreviated. You know, I did my PhD quite a while ago on Mina Loy. And my supervisor was, you know, it was a Elliot Pound expert. So I spent the first year of my PhD with Terrell's companion to the cantos of Ezra Pound, doing this kind of close reading. And I kind of hit this wall, and I was like, there's more in Mina Loy. It isn't just, you know, trying to make her sound like or be like Pound or Elliot. And it was, you know, I was started looking at her and New York Dada and the Futurists. And that's when I kind of encountered the technological. And what started me off was the figure of the cyborg. And that has come back over and over again. So, you know, so Haraway has kind of revisited me, like, I know, in the Ghosts of Christmas Past repeatedly. And I kind of rethink her every time I kind of, you know, come back to thinking about this. What at the time, you know, and I'm talking about the 1990s, we weren't really talking about the post-human. We just had the cyborg. So it was Loy that brought me to technology. And, you know, so my first book, I kind of had a little bit on the cyborg in there, and I put Baroness Elsa, and I became more and more interested in the technological and the impacts of that on particular artists and writers and movements like New York Dada. And then I just wrote this kind of book all that very grandiosely is about the whole of the 20th century and technology and literature and culture. And that then opened doors for me, because the research I did for that then meant I learned about modernism and cinema and photography and particularly modernism and radio. And I spent a long time really interested in modernism and radio. And you know, like Ian, you know, was very interested in that, the kind of cultural history and the cultural context of things in the Second World War and the way that radio featured in that. So, you know, that's kind of my journey. But one of the things that I encountered being interested in modernism and technology, and this is a, you know, this is my personal story, but it was also, you know, some of the motivation behind, you know, what we wanted to include in the book, is that, you know, at least twice when I've been writing on modernism and technology, I've encountered a kind of problematic gatekeeping around what counts and what can be included and who can write about it. So I wrote a book called, you know, Technology, Literature and Culture in the 20th century, or whatever. And a couple of reviews of that book, because of my name, assumed it was written by a man. Well, I've written a previous book that was very clearly feminist. No one assumed that had been written by a man. It still had my name. And we had Google then, so the picture could have been found of me. And then my latest book, Machine Amusements, you know, I'd completed a manuscript of it, and it went off to a reviewer. And I had this Uber reviewer two moments where the reviewer came back and said, okay, but where are the men? And I don't really think you need a chapter on the Harlem Renaissance. And I was like, okay, right. So, you know, and this is, you know, this is 2016, and there's still, you know, people engaging with modernism and technology who think, right, there have to be lots and lots of men, and we don't really need to think about anything beyond technology. We don't need to think about the intersections of race and gender and so on. So, you know, that has been part of my journey into modernism and technology, and why I, you know, really wanted a volume that refused to fall into that kind of pigeonhole where let's have lots of men because they're important. You know, let's put Elliot and Joyce in there because they're really important, and they mention technology occasionally. There's a typewriter somewhere in the wasteland, so we must talk about Elliot. And that, you know, that really paid attention to, you know, other intersectional factors like race. You know, our chapter on radio is really interesting on kind of blindness and hearing. So yeah, so that actually was a longer version of the story that I wanted to tell, but there you go.
And it, well, it's one that does come across because it's you know, there's the sense that, well, one needs to know Joyce and Eliot before one can study these other, you know, Mina Loys and whatnot. And it's very clear that you're centering, you know, interesting, fascinating writers and artists, right? And that brings me to the opening of your book, The Machine Stops. And I'm wondering if you could tell us why you started the book, the introduction, with this E.M. Forster story, 1909, and maybe even just tell us a little bit about the story for people who aren't familiar with it. And what I want to bring it back to is one way I was thinking is, yes, this is about a particular individual's engagement with technology. And it's very prescient, isn't it? And it's very sort of COVID-19 lockdown Zoom. And I think, Ian, you could speak to that. But on the other hand, I was also thinking of the sense of how this person is trapped in a way by the machinery of canonical, you know, or mainstream approaches to teaching modernist works, to writing about modernist works, and the way that you're sort of being a Kuno in this volume by breaking free, by looking out. I don't know that that's too much, but so let's, if we can bring it back to starting with, you open the introduction, and it was great to see, and you correctly mentioned that suddenly everyone was talking about The Machine Stops, E.M. Forster's 1909 short story, when we went into, or many of us went into, to sort of Zoom teaching to lockdown in 2020. So Ian, could you just give us maybe a little brief plot summary of the story, and then mention why it opens the introduction to, you know, these 28 chapters.
Yes, I mean this story was just rattling around in my head at around the time we were writing the introduction, which was sort of that first spring of the lockdown. These collections take time to come together, as that 2-year time lag probably indicates. So if you aren't familiar with The Machine Stops, it's a 1909 long short story. It used to be sort of treated as a novella, but more like a long short story by E.M. Forster, not a guy usually known for his science fiction, but The Machine Stops is set in a sort of a human future in which there's some ecological catastrophe that has sort of devastated the surface of the earth, and everyone lives underground in these little cells. You know, they're self-contained little rooms, and they can have images transmitted to them. They can have audio transmitted to them. They can communicate electronically with people all around the world who are similarly sort of trapped underground in their little honeycomb-like cell. And the character that we meet first is a woman named Vashti, who has a son named Kuno. It's entirely flattering that you think we are like the Kuno figures pointing our readers towards the outside world. But in the story, Vashti is a fairly conventional underground dweller, but Kuno is the sort of almost like a Byronic kind of hero who dares to seek to explore the world outside, and actually, you know, leaves the machine. The reason it's called The Machine Stops is that this kind of all surrounding technological envelope that everyone lives with is simply referred to as the machine. So Kuno actually escapes and looks around the surface, and he gets in trouble for it. But they come to realize that there are actually people still living on the surface of the earth. And anyway, long story short, at the end of the story, the machine starts to break down, and Kuno and his mother Vashti sort of realize that they're not going to escape, but maybe there's the hope that these surface dwellers who have braved this real, tangible, physical existence outside, free of the machine, maybe they will be the hope for humanity's future. So everybody started talking about it because we were all sort of trapped in our little pandemic isolation, and I think craving the kind of human contact that the story The Machine Stops indicates has sort of evaporated by the time of the story's taking place. The other thing that I find interesting about it, which I hadn't thought about when we were writing the introduction, is that everybody in their little, you know, honeycomb-like cell underground is not only just consuming things passively, but they're also producing. Like Vashti listens to lectures that are, you know, broadcast from the other side of the world by someone else in their own little cell, but Vashti also gives her own lectures, and one of the things about the pandemic is that we were all sort of trapped in our world, sending out messages, you know, like, I'm so trapped. Are you trapped too? And, you know, writing think pieces about the machine stops and things like that. So that sense of the technological future being as much about, you know, we are feeding the machine that sustains us, I think is something that resonates. So partly this is about how the pandemic seemed to strangely look a lot like Forster's vision of the world, but also just the fact that Forster in 1909 could imagine this kind of all surrounding technological environment that looked so much like our own world was really prescient. And I think we start with it because, to my mind, it's one of the first articulations of what we might think of as a technological system. It's kind of like interconnected, all surrounding. I keep using the word envelope, but that's what it feels like. It's like you're sort of tucked in this pocket of technological supports, each part of which sort of communicates with the other and helps sustain the other. And that, I think, describes our world in a much more accurate way than, you know, the time machine or the shape of things to come, those H.G. Wells visions of the future. So that's what made the story so present in my mind, as in so many others. And it just seemed like a natural place to start. I will add one last thing, which is that I was worried for a while that it would come to seem very dated in those early months of the pandemic, you know, like, it's front of mind now, but this pandemic is going to be over in 6 months, isn't it? So, yeah. You know, this will all seem very old. 3 years on, it's like, oh boy. Okay. So this is actually going to be with us in one way or another for a while. So the sad news is it's not as dated as I thought it might be.
Well, but also because it's about being embedded in a system, in a technological, you know, ecosystem. So that's never going to date necessarily. But sorry, Alex, did you want to pick up?
No. I was just saying, I mean, I wanted to give credit to Ian for, you know, coming up with that as a way to open it. And I think it was also useful to do because we don't, there's nowhere really in the volume where there's a kind of fully fledged science fictional vision. And I think it was important at the beginning of the introduction with Forster to kind of acknowledge that that is also one way of thinking about, you know, the early 20th century and technology is the kind of future visions that happened in a lot of texts. And Ian Forster isn't usually associated with that as well. So it was a nice way of opening up and you know, shining a light on those kinds of texts, which, you know, do offer visions of the future, which are very, very, very directly about technology rather than, you know, some of the other texts and writers and artists included who aren't necessarily directly about technology. So it's a nice kind of direct opening, I thought. And I've just to reiterate that, how relevant it still is, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And as are, you know, many of the chapters. I mean, that's the other way it sort of sets it up. I mean, it's almost like every chapter could be its own sort of foundation for an edited collection. Do you know what I mean? These are interesting seeds in a way to sort of, you know, let people read, think what's been done, what's going on, and building on it. One of the quotes that I liked from the introduction, and it speaks to this idea of strangeness. And one of the things about when I read the chapters and for students that I taught who read The Machine Stops, was the lack of strangeness, you know, the familiarity, you know, that we see with the engagement with technologies then and now. You have this wonderful quote, for modernists themselves, the technologies of the early 20th century were indeed often strange, even if much of the strangeness lay in the speed with which the extraordinary became assimilated into the fabric of ordinary life. It's a lovely sentence, and I just want to pull out some of the strands there. And I'm curious, this idea of the encounter with the strange, what were some of the strangest or stranger or interesting stories? You know, you're getting all these, this research coming in, right? 28 chapters. What were ones, if you could just relay briefly some of the story or particular story that made you stop, made you think about technology and the strangeness, and strangeness sort of broadly defined, I suppose.
I don't know if it's strangeness, but I stopped and I thought, wow, I didn't know that. And it gave me a different, I don't know, it just opened a little window for me that I had a little look out of it. And it was, so we have a chapter on amplification by Damien Keane. And at the heart of it is a Columbia Masterworks 1950 re-release of some Marlene Dietrich songs, Marlene Dietrich Overseas. You know, when I thought we were going to have a chapter on amplification, I didn't know it was going to be this. And this is why it was, I don't know if it's strange, but it was really in another place. I was kind of looking in the opposite direction to where this contribution came from. And it was just really interesting for me. I think because I was thinking about the sounds as well of the Second World War and so on, to think about. It was a re-release of some songs that Dietrich had recorded. So they're American pop songs with German lyrics that had been written for them, and they were broadcast as a kind of white propaganda to Axis nations in the Second World War. To have Marlene Dietrich singing these American pop songs with German lyrics, and I was just like, wow. And then at the same time that Dietrich is doing this kind of war work, so she's, you know, obviously German born, but had become an American citizen, you know, by then. Also, and she's doing this work for the precursor of the CIA. That's who she's working for. They're not called the CIA then, but they're doing this overseas kind of white propaganda. At the same time, in about 1942, the FBI is opening a file on Marlene Dietrich. So the kind of the contradictions there were just, they were just really astounding for me. And they said a lot to me about America, I think, in all sorts of ways. And the chapter ends up kind of reflecting on America and the contradictions of America and what is remembered and what is forgotten and what is memorialized and what is conveniently, you know, put to one side. So that was just really interesting for me. And I love that we've got that in the volume, that you can kind of be reading and then you come across this chapter and you go, wow, that's really interesting. It's really great to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the richness is that all these, there are so many of these little stories, like you can understand or have a sense of the broader field of what's going on in modernist technology studies. Yeah. But to get this research coming out that's fresh and new, that you can connect with the broader work, I think is fascinating. Yeah. Ian, what were you thinking of?
I really liked also Damian Keene's essay on Marlene Dietrich as in terms of what is sort of surprising or unexpected for the reader. The other sort of nugget that I found strange, I think, is perhaps not strange to people who studied the history of modernism and sexuality, but that's never been one of my areas of focus. So Jana Funke has a chapter on sex, hypnosis, hormones, birth control, and the modernist body, which is just a fantastic and fascinating chapter. If you got hypnosis and hormones and birth control, like, you know, it's going to go some interesting places. But she mentions almost in passing the fact that many modernist authors, I think Yeats and Cocteau and Freud among them, underwent what was known as the Steinach treatment, which is basically a vasectomy. And this was news to me. And they underwent it, sorry, not for the purposes of birth control, but as a means of rejuvenation, of kind of restoring a lost youth or virility through the severing of the vas deferens. And it is just such an encapsulation to me of how willing some modernist authors were to intervene bodily in themselves in pursuit of this kind of myth of authorial greatness, especially of a sort of virile model of authorial greatness on the part of these male writers. And it echoes outwards to, I think, concerns about the sort of health and vitality of the species. This is the parts of modernism that flirt with eugenics, if not, you know, outright subscribe to it. So that fact, which I hadn't encountered before, I don't think, really stood out to me as sort of indicative of just the lengths to which some modernists went to sort of entangle themselves with technology in the pursuit of some kind of goal of aesthetic autonomy and greatness.
And just to go back to the quote, much of the strangeness lay in the speed with which the extraordinary became assimilated into ordinary life. And I suppose most people, when they think about technology and technology's impact on life and work and you know, society broadly, would think of speed maybe as a recurring motif. And I'm just curious, is speed something that comes up throughout in a few of the chapters. I mean, if the hypothesis is we tend to think about modernist technology as a story of speeding up. Does that bear true in looking at the chapters?
Certainly technology is often associated with acceleration. I don't think there's anything wrong with that sort of baseline assumption. You know, technologies are all about making concrete or repeatable certain kinds of desired outcomes or repeated actions, right? You know, a hammer is a hammer because it's great at putting nails in. And so acceleration is always going to be part of that. But I do think that there are some chapters that look at how technology engenders a kind of slowness. And I've got a couple in mind maybe, but I wonder, Alex, if you had any that you wanted to jump in with.
Well, I was thinking about Charles Tung's chapter on clocks, which, you know, it's obviously about time. And it's one of those great that introduces you to clocks and modernism. So you understand the significance of clocks and modernism and then go, okay, now let's think about different kinds of clock. And you kind of shift after the first few pages of that chapter to the big clocks that Charles goes on to write about. And he has a great phrase in there. He talks about clock punk machines, which I just loved. I kind of gave that. So clocks that just kind of, you know, make you rethink. So he refers to big clocks, the clock of the long now, these huge, you know, theoretical or actual clocks that are ticking down the kind of end of the world, as it were. And that shifts from the clocks that you might usually associate with modernism, you know, the wristwatches, the Big Ben in Virginia Woolf and so on, to a completely different scale of clock where the human becomes very, very small and time expands in this huge way. So that's not necessarily onus as such or speed as such. What that made me think of, and this happens in some of the other chapters now, that alongside ideas of speed and slowness in the ways in which modernism engages with technology and the impact of technology, there are also shifts in scale. You know, we've talked about the kind of systems thinking and the technological systems, but you know, you have this huge expansion of scale where you can think of, you know, the universe in a sense, or the time of the planet, or, you know, a huge system, or tiny, tiny, tiny moments, which are also modernism, those kind of moments of being. But in a technological way, they're the invisible. So I'm back to the germs chapter again, which for me is one of the really interesting stories of this volume, that we thought, let's have a chapter on germs. That would be really great. That'd be a really interesting way of thinking about the body. And then COVID happened.
Maeve Long's chapter, right?
Maeve Long's chapter, okay. Yes, absolutely. So, you know, we were thinking, yeah, that'd be really interesting to think about modernism and you know, Maeve Long's phrase, microbial modernism. And then, you know, after we'd, you know, asked for the chapter to be written, then COVID comes along and all of a sudden we are thinking again about the invisible, about, you know, the vulnerability of the body. So, you know, I've moved us at a tangent away from speed and slowness to bigness and smallness, I think, which is also something that technology, you know, from the early 20th century now shows us, you know, tiny, tiny, invisible, and how that, as well as the huge, and how that changes, fundamentally shifts the way that we experience the world, we experience ourselves, we experience other people and the machines we use. Ian, I'm sure you have interesting things to say about slowness rather than size.
Before we get to Ian's, just to revisit Charles Tung, what was his phrase? Clock punk?
Clock punk machines.
Nice. Okay.
Clock punk machines. Yeah. Yeah. Not steampunk, not solar punk, clock punk.
Oh, excellent. I hadn't heard solar punk. That's great. You heard clock punk. You heard it here first, folks. I totally agree. When I was thinking about some of these questions that we might be asked, I wanted to talk about that kind of strange explosion of scales that Alex is talking about. But the other thing that the other way that modernism's relationship to technology resists acceleration is in its tendency to slow us down, at the level of composition and at the level of readership or other engagement, Jennifer Sorensen has a great chapter on print that talks about Anais Nin's kind of embodied engagement with print technology. That's actually almost her title verbatim. I was looking through the manuscript and came across this great excerpt that Jennifer quotes from Nin's journals. So Anais Nin had her own printing press in New York City, I believe, and sort of hand composed or composited some of her works. And she describes it like this in her journals. Take the letter O out of the box, place it next to the T, then a comma, then a space, and so on. Count page 1, 2, 3, and so on. Select the good ones while Gonzalo runs the machine day after day. The writing is often improved by the fact that I live so many hours with a page that I am able to scrutinize it, to question the essential words. The discipline of typesetting and printing is good for the writer. And that quote just stands out to me as just really showing how a machine that's meant to accelerate things can actually engender a slowness on the author, which can then probably has to be reciprocated to some extent by the reader. If the work is labored over and dense and sort of, you know, knotty in that modernist way that we like to talk about, then the reader will often labor over things too. So sometimes there's these counterintuitive chronological effects.
You're absolutely right in about the slowness that is in some senses implicit in what we do with modernism. You know, I'm right back reading Ezra Pound with Terrell's companion, the cantos, going, this is really, but that slowness is so rewarding as well. I love the slowness as well as the acceleration.
Yes.
I was thinking, because we get Enda Duffy writing on automobiles and they're saying a lot about speed. And then I don't know if it's the chapter right after, but then I was reading Alex Beeston's on photography, which is, you know, a photograph. It was a slower technology then. Yeah. But also the idea of a photograph slows things down so we can take a look and consider and think. And in a way, you know, I revise my thesis or hypothesis in looking at the chapters, and in a way that the modernist technology studies is about slowness, in that each chapter allows us to stop and pause and linger over things that might have been experienced as strange, as speedy, and technologies that today we see as strange and speedy, but the process, the work is to slow things down, right? To find evidence and to communicate it. And I was wondering if one of your consciousnesses of bringing together of a work of this volume, of these numbers of chapters, is this idea of people working on technology, the materiality, say, like David Trotter's chapter, and then people looking at technology as metaphor, again, just to maybe be too simplistic, but this idea of who's working on, let's research into stuff, useful stuff, I believe David Trotter's chapter mentions, and then who's looking at the way technology changed thinking, changed perception. Were you consciously thinking of having that balance? Because it's there. I'm just wondering, did you just let people, I mean, and I suppose in most of the works, there is that balance itself. It's just some take the lead with the material, some take the lead with the more metaphorical. I'm just curious how you saw technology playing out between the material and the metaphorical in each of the chapters, as you read each one, as you thought about organizing it and editing it.
I mean, the organizing is where I'm thinking, because we had the subsections, but chapters moved around between them, which already suggests that in one way of thinking, you know, when you're asking someone to write a chapter on a particular topic, you're going, yeah, it's going to fit into media. And then you read it and you go, actually, it's not about media, even though it has a title that fits into the media section. So it was a more organic process of having our authors just doing their thing and, you know, giving them. So what we did is we came up with a list of just the single word titles, and we were very committed to those. So all of the contributions in the book have one word, and then eventually we allowed the authors to have a nice subtitle. We said, go on, you can all have a subtitle. But they are called things like automobiles, robots, materials, infrastructure, techniques, those kinds of things. So we had an idea, I think, of what we thought should be written or might be written. And, you know, people gave us, you know, short abstracts and then we organized them. But then when they came back, there were differences in approach. You're absolutely right that some of the contributors are very concerned with the fact of technology and with explaining the fact of that technology. And I don't mean the literal fact, you know, it could be a technological system or a form of media. Whereas there are other places where there is that more kind of conceptual thinking. And I think, you know, Enda Duffy's chapter on automobiles is an example of that, because it's about the fact of windscreens, but it is actually about technological modes of seeing. As much as it is about cars or windscreens. So it just takes that motif of looking through the windscreen and how that features in particular ways in art and writing, and then using that as a kind of launch pad for thinking about that speeded up mode of seeing that the car windscreen, you know, signifies.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think the only thing I would add is that just having a volume of this breadth, we knew there'd be, we thought 28 to 30 chapters-ish. And you just know that you're going to get a range of approaches and different balances of all the different elements of theoretical versus sort of historical or materialist thinking. So at a certain level, that's the beauty of a project this big, is that you'll have a real strength in that diversity. And I'll just add, this is a sort of different question than the one you asked, but that breadth, I think, also shows itself in the different approach that some writers have taken to the idea of this being a companion. You know, is it supposed to be an introduction to a topic, or is it supposed to be a forum for original research? And we told all of our authors, well, we'd like at least a little bit of the introduction and then mostly original research. And everybody struck a different balance. So some chapters are just these sort of masterful overviews of long and complex histories of how modernists have thought about a given technology. And other ones are like, we're going to talk about that quickly. And now I'm going to tell you about this work that I think is so vital and embodies that, you know, that relationship between a given technology and the modernist era. So everybody has taken a different approach. And that's, to my mind, just a great thing. We're so delighted with all the chapters that came together for this volume.
Yeah, and that's what
it means. Sorry, I was saying, it means you end up with chapters like the one that you mentioned, Mike, on Alex Beeston's on photography and Gertrude Kaiserbier. I can't pronounce that name, you know, so it's on photography and modernism. But what we get is Beeston's amazing work on this woman photographer, you know, working in New York, who's outside the Stieglitz circle, who's working in commercial ways and taking photographs of her family. And it's just, you know, if you'd said, I want an overview of modernism and photography, you would not have ended up with that stunning piece that also comes with beautiful images as well, which is lovely. You know, one thing I really like about the book is that Edinburgh allowed us to have as many images as we have in it. So it is a lovely thing to look at in parts as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of pretty images. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, there's lots and lots of great images. And the way you gave the authors freedom, you get a history of each topic, as you mentioned, but the way the book is animated, if you will, it's not every chapter starts off the same. It's not, you know, formulaic at all. And you get that sort of history in different places, in different chapters. One of the things that, and also you get these nice overlaps. And one thing, it seems to all come back to the body in some way. You have a section on bodies, and I'm wondering how, I'm glad, Alex, you mentioned how tricky it was, and it shows the richness of the work in that you think it's going to fit into one section, and in some ways it does, but in the writing of it, actually it moves into another section. With bodies, you have a great quote. I think it's Mark Goebel.
Yeah.
Right? Beautiful circuits. Modernist expression wants to wire bodies into circuits with all manner of machines. This idea of wiring bodies, wires come up a lot. Bodies come up a lot. You start off with Vashti, and there's a lot of attention to her body in The Machine Stops, the Ian Forster story that starts the introduction. And it seems like a lot of the chapters do bring it back to if not the human, the body. And I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts about looking through, having read, having edited the work, any takeaways of this idea of the technology's impact on the body, both physical, but also bringing up the idea of perception and conception that we talked about.
I mean, the overarching answer that I think would connect all the chapters in that, at least that section for me, is I have a newly sharpened sense of just how thoroughly kind of interpenetrated our bodies are by the technologies we surround ourselves with. And that may be a relatively banal observation, but this working on this collection really sharpened that for me. In terms of something a little more specific, I mean, I was thinking about Joshua Lamb's chapter in the volume on race, which is about Fordism factories and the mechanical reproduction of racial identity, which gives a really great examination. I was going to say an overview, but it also drills down really deeply on novels by Ralph Ellison, Aldous Huxley, and others, and how modern sort of factory production techniques, Fordism in particular, kind of helped to create the racial categories that that we know and live with today, and how modernist authors were sort of in the midst of it or shortly after the inception of Fordism already understanding how industrial production sort of creates racial difference through managerial practices labor practices, the sort of global inequities of you know, who gets a safe working environment and a decent paycheck, etc. So that kind of the fact that something as seemingly unconnected to our individual bodies as like management practices can actually have a profound effect on our perception of, in this case, racial difference, was indicative of that relationship, I think.
Yeah, yes. That's a fascinating chapter. That really is. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I'll start with the cyborg again and it all makes sense eventually. I mean, for me, you know, everything I do as a feminist, you know, that's what guides me. And, you know, for me, that's underpinned by a sense that of the unnatural, you know, a kind of resistance to the naturalization of certain ways of being, the naturalization of bodies and so on. And so for me, what modernism and technology shows us, what so many of the chapters in the volume show us, is that the body has never been natural. But what technology shows us is the kind of permeable boundaries of the body, the way that the body is always supplemented, interpenetrated, supported by, assisted by, or part of huge technological systems and cannot be separated from those. And that is a way of undoing this kind of, you know, the really problematic notion of the sovereign human subject and all that has gone wrong with that. And, you know, a modernist technology study, for me, and so many of the, you know, contributions are about that looking, breaking down that idea of this stable subject and inserting it into various ways, into different arguments and discourses, and exploring different representations of that. And I think, Ian's already mentioned Jan Funke's chapter on sex, and it's so important to have a chapter like that in a book like this, you know, showing us that, you know, sex is the product of technoscience. It does not exist outside of technoscience. But also, and this is what I love about that chapter, that you know, the attempt of technoscience to define and delineate sex actually amplifies that which cannot be captured. You know, aspects of sex and sexuality and desire which escape, you know, the strictures and structures of technoscience, and shows us, you know, the unnaturalness of sex itself. And it's important to have contributions like that. But I think, yes, the body is, you know, when we were thinking about, you were mentioning the sections, I was thinking, yeah, the robots chapter, you know, Catherine Schindler's robots could be in the bodies section because it's about robotic bodies. You know, it happens to be in the machine section. It doesn't need to be in there. So there is that persistent return to what is the impact of technologies on the individual or the social body or the body of the nation, and how those have to be rethought and reconfigured. You know, Jennifer Sorensen's, you mentioned this again, Ian, you're stealing my thunder on everything. I was revisiting that chapter and thinking, yeah, it's actually about the body. It's about the, you know, the profoundly embodied experience of technology that you get from typesetting, from working with a printing press. And for me, that kind of, you know, that recognition that it's not a disembodied experience of working with the materiality of prints. It's not, it can be fragmenting, but it's not necessarily disembodying. Foreshadows for me, you know, the way that we now kind of rethink our screen life, that it isn't just about a separation from our bodies and an entry into some kind of, you know, transcendent cyberspace, that actually our interactions with technology remind us of our bodies so much that we cannot escape the body through technology. It is not a disembodied experience. And I think, you know, that comes through in so many of the contributions, that it's not about disembodiment. It's about, the different experiences of the body, the different boundaries of the body, the different scales of body that can be experienced or understood through technology. Yeah.
Definitely. The two words that come to mind in thinking of the collection is embodied and embedded. And we can end with where we started in a way, and how I mentioned how I thought the machine stops, on the one hand, helps us think about the impact of technology on ourselves, but also we can think of that story or your use of that story as speaking about the field, modernist technology studies, teaching modernism, the humanities. You have a quote, again, in the introduction: the machines of modernism were embedded in complex networks of association and configuration. And I was thinking of the machines of modernism, meaning the writers and artists of a particular period, but the machines of teaching modernism, of getting hired in modernism. I was thinking about, again, thinking of Vashti and her cell, of people being siloed into different departments and the work of interdisciplinarity. And so to end, Ian, when he was talking about the machine stops, he said it's about humanity's future, and that's TY, right? Humanity's apostrophe S future. But I heard it as humanity's future, right?
Yes,
the future of humanities. And so in some way, if you could just mention as a way of ending, what does this the process of putting together this book, of reading these rich chapters on a very particular subject, but also their different approaches, what does this tell us about, how does it make connections with today in terms of technology today, the way technology is embodied, our screen cultures, as Alex mentioned, but also, and you may want to lean on this instead, is what did putting this together, and in what ways are you trying to maybe challenge assumptions about, you know, the teaching of modernism and taking interdisciplinary approaches, and so thinking about the machines of modernism being embedded in complex networks of association and configuration. In what ways are you trying to analyze these machines, but also upset, disrupt, provide some sort of innovation and intervention?
Wow. Yeah, any disruption that can happen as the result of an academic book is fine by me. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think working with the range of scholars that we've worked with on the volume at different stages and different positions, and that itself showed the kind of richness of interdisciplinary working that's at the centre, I think, and should be at the centre of the new modernist studies, and also the pitfalls of it, because not everybody is tenure track. Not every, you know, there are contingent people. There are people, you know, whose, you know, the humanities is not in a good place in the UK at the moment. I don't know if you're aware of the UK. Yes, we don't need to revisit that. So there's a kind of precarity, I think, that's implicit in this attempt to be interdisciplinary, this attempt, this refusal to be canonical, this attempt to try and push some boundaries and redefine, that there is a precarity about that, you know, because it doesn't serve, you know, various forces of that kind of reproduce the status quo. And that's a dangerous place to be. But there was one thing, you know, how does this predict the future, that occurred to me. I was rereading James Purdon on Literature and Information. Okay. And this is very topical, she says. But thinking about that resistance, he's talking about a resistance in modernism to texts that are read for information instead of literary texts, which have everything that are in terms of creativity and everything. And I'm thinking this is the debate about AI writing, isn't it? This is like, you know, that we're back now where you know, you're facing a form of technology that can, you know, not just create undergraduate essays for you, but that can write children's storybooks. And that, you know, this technology is stripping us of the ability to be creative, to interact in a human way through technology, through literature, through text itself. And for me, that's just, you know, that's the same debate that James Purdon was finding in when he was looking at literature and information in the modernist era. So it's the same. So that what occurs to me and what occurred to me when I was re-looking at these chapters is that many of those debates about what is the purpose of technology, who owns the technological imaginary, you know, about the uneven access to technology, and also what is technology doing to the human and human creativity, they are also still the questions we are debating. And I'm sure if you talk to a Victorianist, they would also be the questions that are being debated in the 19th century. And so we like to claim our area is unique. And there certainly is a uniqueness to modernist studies, but it's not the only place where this kind of rich questioning happens. So that's what I'd like to say anyway.
Yeah, that's a perfect note to end on. I don't think I have anything to add. So Alex, I think
it's a wonderful note to end on. And congratulations to you both and to all your contributors. It's an excellent collection. Again, the Edinburgh Companion to Modernism and Technology, just quite recently out by Edinburgh University Press. Thank you, Alex Goody, and thank you, Ian Whittington, for joining us. And thank you all for listening to another episode of Stories from the Space Between.